living with Bracknell. Danvers felt truly sorry for Melina. By this time he regarded the biologist as a friend, the only friend he had in this den of idolaters and atheists. Their relationship was adversarial, to be sure, but he was certain that Melina enjoyed their barbed exchanges as much as he himself did. Sooner or later he'll break down and tell me what's truly troubling him. Many, many weeks passed before Danvers realized there was something about Melina that was jarringly out of place. What's Victor doing here on this damnable project? Why is a biologist involved in building the Sky Tower?
New Kyoto. Nobuhiko Yamagata stood at his office window gazing out at the city spread out far below him. Lake Biwa glittered in the distance. A flock of large birds flapped by, so close that Nobu inadvertently twitched back away from the window. He was glad no one was in the office to see his momentary reaction. It might look like cowardice to someone, unworthy weakness at least. The birds were black gulls, returning from their summer grounds far to the north, a sign that winter is approaching, Nobuhiko knew. Winter. He grunted to himself, "There hasn't been enough natural snow to ski on since my father died." Nobu looked almost like a clone of his illustrious father, a few centimeters taller than Saito, but stocky, short-limbed, his face round and flat, his brown eyes hooded, unfathomable. The main difference between father and son was that while Saito's face was lined from frequent laughter, the lines on Nobu's face came from worry. He hadn't heard from his father for more than a year now. The elder Yamagata had gone into a fit of regret over the killings out in the asteroid belt and become a true lama, full of holy remorse and repentance. "It's as if he's died again," Nobu thought. "He's cut off all contact with the world outside his lamasery, even with his only son." The clock chimed once. "No matter," Nobuhiko thought as he turned from the window. "I can carry my burdens without father's help." Squaring his shoulders, he said to the phone on the desk, "Call them in." The double doors to his office swung inward, and a half-dozen men in nearly identical dark business suits came in, each bearing a tiny gold flying crane pin in his lapel, each bowing respectfully to the head of Yamagata Corporation. They took their places at the long table abutting Nobu's desk, like the stem of the letter T. No women served on this committee. There were several women on Yamagata's board of directors, but the executive committee was a completely male domain. There was only one item on their agenda, the Sky Tower. Nobuhiko sat in his high-backed leather desk chair and called the meeting to order. They swiftly dispensed with formalities such as reading the minutes of the previous meeting. They all knew why they were here. Swiveling slightly to his right, Nobu nodded to the committee's chairman. Officially, Nobuhiko was an ex officio member of the executive committee, present at their meetings, but without a vote in their deliberations. It was a necessary arrangement to keep outsiders from accusing that Yamagata Corporation was a one-man dictatorship, which it very nearly was. Nobu might not have had a vote on this committee, but the committee never voted against his known wishes. "We are here to decide what to do about the Sky Tower project," said the chairman, his eyes on Nobuhiko. "It is progressing satisfactorily?" Nobu asked, knowing full well the answer. "They are well ahead of schedule," said the youngest member of the committee, down at the end of the conference table. Nobuhiko let out a patient sigh. "When that tower goes into operation," fumed one of the older men, "it will knock the bottom out of the launch services market." One of Nobu's coups, once he took the reins of the corporation from his father, had been to acquire the American firm Masterson Aerospace Corporation. Masterson had developed the Clipper Ship launch vehicle, the rocket that reduced launch costs from thousands of dollars per pound to hundreds. The doughty little, completely reusable vehicle that not only opened up orbital space to industrial development, but also served, in a modified version, as hypersonic transport that carried passengers to any destination on Earth in less than an hour. By acquiring Masterson, Yamagata gained a major share not only of the world's space launching market, but of long-distance air travel as well. "One tower?" scoffed one of the other elder members from across the conference table. "How badly can one tower cut into the launch services market? How much capacity can it have?" The other man closed his eyes briefly as if seeking strength to deal with a fool. "It is not merely the one tower. It is the first sky tower. If it succeeds, there will be others." Nobu agreed. "And why pay for clipper ships to go into orbit when you can ride a sky tower for a fraction of the cost?"
"Exactly so, sir."
"The sky tower is a threat, then?"
"Not an immediate threat. But if it is successful within a few years, such towers will spring up all along the equator."
"Fortunate for us," said another, smiling, "that most of the equator is over deep ocean instead of land." No one laughed. "How much of our profit comes from clipper ship operations?" Nobuhiko asked.
"Not as much from space launch services as from air transportation here on Earth," said the controller, seated on Yamagata's left.
Nobu said softly, "The numbers, please."
The controller tapped hurriedly on the palm comp in his hand. "It's about 8%, 8.4 so far this year. Last fiscal year, 8.2.
"It's pretty constant."
"Rising slightly."
Nobu folded his hands across his vest, a gesture he remembered his father using often.
"Can we afford to lose 8% of our profits?" asked the youngster.
"Not if we don't have to," said the controller. "We own part of this Sky Tower project, don't we?" Nobu asked.
"We bought into it, yes. We have a contract to supply engineers and other technical staff and services. But it's only a minor share of their operation, less than 5%, and the contract will terminate once they begin operations."
Nobu felt his brows rise. "We won't share in their operating profits?" The controller hesitated.
"Not unless we negotiate a new contract for maintenance or other services, of course."
"Of course," Nobuhiko muttered darkly. Sweat broke out on the controller's forehead. The office fell silent. Then the director of the corporation's aerospace division cleared his throat and said, "May I point out that all of our discussion is based on the premise that the Sky Tower will be successful. There is no guarantee of that." Nobuhiko understood him perfectly. "The Sky Tower could be a failure if we take action to make certain it fails." Looking around the conference table, he saw that each and every member of the executive committee understood the unspoken decision.
Ciudad de Cielo. Elliot Danvers was not brilliant, but he was not stupid either. And he possessed a stubborn determination that allowed him to push doggedly onward toward a goal when others would find easier things to do. "Why is a biologist working on the Sky Tower project?" When he asked Molina directly, the man became reticent and evasive. "What's a new morality minister doing here, in Ecuador?" Molina would counter. When Danvers frankly explained that his mission was to provide spiritual comfort to all who sought it, Molina cocked an eyebrow at him. "Aren't you here to snoop on us, Elliot?" Molina asked good-naturedly. "Aren't your superiors in Atlanta worried that this project is a modern Tower of Babel?" Nonsense, Danvers sputtered. "Is it? My take on the new morality is that they don't like change. They've arranged North America just the way they like it, with themselves in control of the government." "Control of the government?" Danvers was truly shocked at that. "We're a religious organization, not a secular one." "So was the Spanish Inquisition," Molina murmured. Despite their differences, they remained friends of a sort, bantering, challenging friends. Danvers knew quite well that the only other man in Sky City that Molina regarded as a friend was the project director, Mance Bracknell. But something had come between them. No, not something, Danvers thought. Someone. Lara Tierney. Molina invited Danvers to have dinner with him from time to time. Once they joined Bracknell and Lara on a quick jaunt to Quito and dined in the best restaurant Danvers had ever seen.